Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now!
My name is Adele Welty. My son, Timothy Welty, was a firefighter. He was lost in the line of duty on September 11th at the World Trade Center.
My name is Robert McElvain. My son, Bobby, died at the World Trade Center and worked for Merrill Lynch.
My name is Andrew Rice. My brother, David Rice, worked at the World Trade Center and was lost that day as well.
Today, the families of victims of September 11th, 2 years later. They'll describe their loved ones, they'll describe the day, and they'll talk about their journeys over these past 2 years. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The peace blow yesterday as Hamas carried out two suicide bombings, killing 15, and Israeli forces killed at least 7 Palestinians. The day of violence began in Hebron, where Israeli forces killed 3, including a 12-year-old Palestinian boy who was shot by a tank. Later in the day, a pair of suicide bombs went off 5 hours apart. One hit near a crowded bus stop near a Tel Aviv military base. 8 Israelis died. The other exploded outside a night cafe in Jerusalem, killing 7. Dozens were wounded in the attacks. Among those killed in Jerusalem was a doctor who headed the emergency room where many of the wounded were taken. The doctor, David Applebaum, was in the cafe with his daughter, Nava, on the eve of her wedding. The violence continued this morning when Israeli warplanes destroyed the home of Hamas leader Mahmoud Zahar. While he survived the assassination attempt, his son and bodyguard died in the attack. The Associated Press reports the bombing marked the first time Israeli forces attacked a Hamas leader in his home. After the attacks, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon cut short his trip to India to return. The Israeli cabinet is meeting today to decide whether to launch a major invasion of Gaza or to expel Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. And last night, at a debate among the Democratic presidential candidates sponsored by the Congressional Black Caucus, former Vermont Governor Howard Dean and Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman clashed over Dean's recent comment that the U.S. should not take sides in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Dean backed his statement up last night, saying it's the only way for the U.S. to be, quote, a credible negotiator in the peace talks. Lieberman lashed back, saying, quote, Howard Dean's statements break a 50-year record in which presidents, Republican and Democrat, members of Congress of both parties have supported our relationship with Israel based on shared values and common strategic interests. In response to Lieberman's criticism, Dean responded, quote, it doesn't help Joe, to demagogue the issue. Dean had been previously criticized by some for taking a hardline stance on Israel. When asked by The Forward, a Jewish weekly in New York, whether his views were closer to the group Americans for Peace Now or the pro-Sharon American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, Dean said, quote, my view is closer to AIPAC's view. In addition, in August, Dean named the former head of AIPAC, Stephen Grossman, to a top campaign post. During 4 hours of intense questioning from Senators Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz and General Richard Myers, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, yesterday admitted they could not say how long U.S. troops would have to remain in Iraq or when international troops would arrive to relieve the U.S. forces. Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia reiterated his opposition to the war, saying, quote, this is a war we should never have fought. On the request for $78 billion, he said, Congress is not an ATM. Democratic Senator Carl Levin of Michigan added, quote, this huge sum is a bitter pill for the American people to swallow. Republican Senator Charles Hagel of Nebraska criticized the lack of post-war planning and raised the possibility that Bush would fire some of the high-profile war planners. Hagel said, this business is all about accountability. Cabinet members are accountable. The questioning came on the same day a car bomb exploded outside a U.S. intelligence office in northern Iraq, killing three Iraqis and injuring almost 50 people, including six Americans. And near Baghdad, a U.S. soldier died last night after a bomb exploded near his vehicle. The death was the first reported by the U.S. military in 8 days. By a one-vote margin, the Republican House of Representatives last night approved a school voucher program for Washington, D.C. If approved by the Senate, it would become the nation's first federally funded program to give students public grants to attend private schools. A federal judge ruled yesterday that victims of the September 11th attacks can sue the airlines, the landlord of the World Trade Center, and the aircraft maker involved. Also yesterday, a group of insurers announced they would file a $500 billion lawsuit against Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, Sudan, and dozens of individuals and organizations they claim are responsible for the September 11th attacks. In Boston, the Catholic Church has agreed to pay out $85 million in a settlement to victims abused by priests. This news from the California recall. Peter Uberoth, the former baseball commissioner, has dropped out of the race. The Hungarian-born physicist Edward Teller, who was known as the father of the hydrogen bomb, has died at the age of 95. Europe's highest court yesterday held up the right of Italy to ban genetically modified food until proper testing can determine the food safety. In Afghanistan, four workers with the Danish Committee for Aid to Afghan Refugees died yesterday after being ambushed. Some said the Taliban carried out the attack. Argentina yesterday announced it has defaulted on a $3 billion debt to the International Monetary Fund. The default comes after the Argentine president, Néstor Kirchner, refused demands of the IMF to compensate banks for the collapse of the value of the peso and to give utility firms the ability to raise prices. The BBC reports the demands were hugely unpopular among citizens who saw them as the IMF attempting to help out big business at the expense of the poor. Thousands of unemployed Argentines demonstrated yesterday against the IMF. One said, quote, "Instead of paying the IMF, we should pay to improve our public health system, boost teachers' salaries, and end hunger in our devastated country." Meanwhile, in Cancun, thousands of protesters are in the Mexican resort town where the World Trade Organization is holding negotiations. Rick Rowley of Big Noise Films is there and prepared this report for Democracy Now!
We come here to make an offering to all those who have been killed by this empire and by decisions made by summits like these. The most important thing for us is to take the streets, to bring life to the streets. We do not want to dialogue with the WTO. We want to speak to the people. Tuesday morning, as some of the delegates to this fifth ministerial of the World Trade Organization helicoptered into their luxury hotels, 3,000 people marched in downtown Cancun, Mexico, launching a week of protest against the meetings. The WTO is in crisis, and it hopes that Cancun can rescue its public image, tarnished by its defeat in Seattle in 1999 and its humiliating retreat to Qatar in 2001. Its general director has stated that failure is not an option, and the Mexican government has deployed 20,000 police, built a series of 8-foot steel and barbed wire fences blocking the hotel zone, and stationed 3 naval PT boats off the coast of the Hilton Hotel to prevent protests from having an impact on the negotiations. But movements against corporate globalization have also been mobilizing for months, and Cancun is flooded with farm workers, students, and activists from across Mexico and around the world. Tuesday's march was intended as a peaceful and symbolic beginning to what will be an increasingly militant week of protest and direct action. The march began at Beto Avila Baseball Stadium, where youth and student activists are camping, and reached the first wall of the police blockade. The march was animated by music, protesters wore colorful masks and costumes, and the mood was festive in spite of temperatures reaching 36 degrees Celsius and humidity close to 100%. In front of the barricades, a Mayan ceremony and an offering was made to those killed in the economic and military wars of empire. Protesters climbed the police fence and hung banners from it, but chose to avoid confrontation today. With larger protests scheduled for the 10th, 12th, and 13th, protesters plan to return and physically challenge the police blockades on another day. For Democracy Now!, this is Rick Rowley reporting from The Real Cancun.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom in this land? Pays the cost for the liberties you demand.
Sarah Thompson, Is It for Freedom? Here on Democracy Now!. I'm Amy Goodman. Tomorrow is the second anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and the plane crash in Pennsylvania. In these 2 years, the Bush administration has used the events of September 11th to push ahead with a massive-scale war that it has dubbed the War on Terror. First, the U.S. bombed Afghanistan, killing thousands of civilians. The country remains a war zone, with the United States and other foreign troops occupying large parts of it. Last March, despite no evidence linking the government of Iraq to the September 11th attacks, President Bush launched a massive shock and awe campaign against Iraq, followed by an invasion of some 140,000 U.S. troops. Like Afghanistan, thousands of innocent civilians have been killed, and as the U.S. occupation of the country drags on and many U.S. soldiers die, the situation is boiling into a civil war. The corporate media and U.S. officials seized on the tragedy of September 11th to whip up a frenzy of what was called patriotism. Bush told the world, you are with us or you are with the terrorists. But a small group of families who lost loved ones in the September 11th attacks have raised their voices over this past 2 years under the banner Peaceful Tomorrows. Today we'll spend the hour hearing the stories of these people and hearing about their individual journeys over this past 2 years since they've lost brothers, sons, sisters, fathers, husbands, wives. For some of them, the journeys have taken them into the homes of ordinary Afghans who had families, members killed by the U.S. missiles. Others to the homes of Iraqis whose families were killed by U.S. bombs over the last 10 years. Some of these people have traveled across this country promoting peace and opposing the use of the loss of their loved ones to justify war. Others have campaigned internationally. Some just talked to their family and friends. A new book tells their stories. It's called September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, Turning Our Grief into Action for Peace. Today, we'll start with Bob McIlvaine. Bob, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. It's a long journey. 2 years is not a long time, but you know, I look back and it's just, it truly is a journey. But my son, he's 26 years old, and here we go again. I always have trouble this part of it. Trust me, I keep saying this. I talk a lot, but this part is always the toughest. I was 26 years old, graduated from Princeton. We were from the Philadelphia area, and came. I just loved New York. And with his love of New York, I'd move up here because the connection is just so great. I feel the energy is always here. So anyway, he came to New York, started out in publishing. He was an English major at Princeton, and he always wanted to be a writer, had two manuscripts working when he died at the World Trade Center. But he also wanted to do everything else. He truly was a Renaissance man because he had an unquenchable desire for knowledge. And he wanted to go into the business world. So he went from publishing, worked for Random House, went to Burson Marsteller. And his only client was Merrill Lynch. And Merrill Lynch loved him so much, they made a position for him as a vice president of media relations. And he took the job in June of 2001. And in taking the job, he actually negotiated the contract where they would sponsor him for his MBA. So he really wanted to get into the business world also, and also be a writer. So he had just started there in June of 2001. And when September 11 came, I worked at acute care psychiatric facility for 6 to 18-year-olders. And someone said on the TV that World Trade Center had been hit by a plane, so I watched. You know, I was watching the TV, and I didn't think Bobby had anything to do with it because he worked for Merrill Lynch, who was up on Vesey Street, you know, across from the World Trade Center. So I wasn't too upset about it. I mean, of course, I was upset, but about my son. And then my wife called and said, well, look, we haven't heard from him. So we spent the whole day, you know, wondering, you know, hopefully getting a call from, but we never did get a call. Then on Wednesday, I came up here, and like all the people in New York, going from hospital to hospital to hospital, just trying to get some information. And I sort of felt that, you know, that was it, because he would have called. Well, on Thursday, we had some 20-some people looking for Bobby, and actually had a good friend of mine, I was in fact talking to him, or a good friend of my son, hired a detective, and we got the information on Thursday, the 13th, that they found the body and he had died. And we truly were lucky because we did get a body. And I'm in a support group in Philadelphia, and I'm the only one in that support group that has a body. And that's, and it is, I mean, you know, I hate to keep talking about that, but I just want to emphasize the grief of we're in all tremendous grief. And the fact that I have a body, you know, I'm that one step up in hell, because I have a place to go every Sunday to, you know, talk to my son. So after that, you know, it was really difficult. You know, my wife, we just didn't know what to do. You know, you're just, the grief is just so heavy. And we were lucky to run into some just wonderful people, a psychiatrist up here, and she just gave us such great tools to work with. And I think the greatest one I got is talking about our family. You're all on a ski slope with broken legs, and each one of you has to figure a way to get down, and emphasizing the point that everybody's grief is different, you know. And so these little tools really started helping. And we formed this support group down in Philadelphia, and that, to me, has been the greatest thing we have, because every week we have something in common to talk about. And so the first year I spent, I never did find out how Bobby died. He was supposed to be on the 106th floor. We thought the possibility of him jumping from the 106th floor, but I just... I spent the whole year trying to figure out what happened to Bobby. And to this day, I still want to know what that last second was. Did a beam fall on him? Was he helping someone? Was he running? And for some reason, I just want to find that information out. Well, after a year, I just figured, well, this wasn't helping me much, because my youngest son is really, he's still struggling. And I think he spent a whole year trying to caretake for us, and we didn't recognize the horrible grief that he's going through also. So then I really wanted to get active. I never at once thought that the war in Afghanistan was right. 2 weeks before, I was talking to Bobby about how we thought that Bush is going to find a way to go to war with the Taliban. And, you know, it was just unbelievable that this happened, and suddenly we're at war with Afghanistan. So somehow I wanted to be able to get my message out that I do not want this war. And, of course, by yourself at home, it's very difficult to do. So I went on the website, and I finally found Peaceful Tomorrows, and I sent a donation to him, and David Petorti called me, and then that's how I got involved and started going to the demonstrations. And my wife finds this very difficult to do. She's 100% behind me, but she just can't deal with it. You know, it just brings out too many emotions for something. She just can't do it. Although she's, you know, 100% behind me. So I spent a year going to the demonstrations, meeting the people from Peaceful Tomorrows, and it's just such a wonderful group. And it's the fact that you can get a voice out there. And it's so important to get a voice. And I have so many feelings, and I have so many ideas, and there's just so many things I want to do. And Peaceful Tomorrows has just given me that opportunity in my neighborhood. And it gives me the impetus to constantly read. You know, knowledge is the power of life. And this is the thing I want to try to get out to people. And I'm an educator, and it's a matter of educating people. And
well, Bob, we're going to break, okay. And when we come back, we're going to hear from Adele Welty, who's the mother of a firefighter, from Jeremy Glick, who lost his father. He worked at Port Authority at the World Trade Center. From Andrew Rice, whose brother David died at the World Trade Center. And we'll also hear about what happened at Windows on the World, that restaurant on top of the World Trade Center, where so many dozens of workers died. Fekak Mamduth was a worker who had the night shift. He lost so many of his friends and colleagues, and now he has worked organizing survivors and will tell us their story. And we'll speak with others as well. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! That was The Silence and Sorrow by New York guitarist Lauren Mazzacane Connors. He wrote and recorded the song hours after the towers, the World Trade Center, collapsed. Today begins our three-part series on the second anniversary of September 11, 2001, as we're joined by family members of those lost at the World Trade Center. Tomorrow, we will take a look at September 11th in history from around the world. 1973 coup in Chile, when Salvador Allende died in the palace as the U.S.-backed Pinochet regime rose to power. In 1977, the murder of Stephen Biko, September 11th and 12th, 1977. 1990 in Guatemala, Myrna Mack assassinated there by U.S.-backed security forces, and of course the 2001 attacks in the United States. On Friday, who profits from 9/11? Prisons, private companies, Pentagon, and politicians. We'll be looking at the prison system, and we'll talk with Joe Connison, who's written a book on the lies since 9/11. But today, the survivors, the family members who lost loved ones at the World Trade Center. Adele Welty, we welcome you to the firehouse where we broadcast from, this 100-year-old firehouse, Engine Company 31, that is now a community media center, downtown community television, DCTV. Familiar surroundings?
Timmy would love it.
You don't have to wear it.
Okay. Timmy loved being a firefighter. His entire life revolved around being a firefighter. His wife and son often went to see him at the firehouse. And even in his off time, he played ball for the firemen, for the fire department. He skied for the fire department. He played hockey on the fire department team. And on September 11th, he had just finished a shift and was about to leave for home when the first plane struck. He was in Squad 288, which shared the firehouse with Hazmat 1. And because he was off duty, he didn't get on the Squad 288 truck when it left the firehouse. He called his wife and said he would not be home to take Jake to pre-nursery school. And he jumped on the hazmat truck. And because he was not officially on duty, we didn't know, and the firehouse didn't know where he was for several days afterwards. It was concluded that he had gone. We didn't know what had happened to him for weeks afterwards. It was thought that there might be people still alive in the ruins, somewhere in an area that still had air. But by the end of October, we knew that there wasn't hope anymore, and we had his memorial service. In December, we were contacted by the medical examiner's office that they had identified some of his remains. But we thought we would wait and get a full recovery. We didn't. So in September of 2002, September the 10th, we held his funeral. And my daughter-in-law chose to have him cremated because he had often expressed the wish that he not be buried and that he be cremated. And we took a fire department boat and buried his ashes at sea, which he had also requested. Timmy was the only one of my children that often talked about what we should do if anything happened to him. He always pushed the envelope. He was a fearless young man. He was not a reckless person. He took only what he called calculated risks. But within that rubric, he loved to do things that were exciting. He liked to parachute and water. I don't know what you call that, where you get on a water ski and you go up into the air. Sailing. He was devoted to his family. He spent all his free time with his son Jake, who still misses him desperately. We all miss him desperately. He was like the glue that held the family together. He was always arranging get-togethers and calling people at 7 o'clock in the morning and saying, "Hey, we're going fishing today." It didn't matter whether you wanted to or not. It was, "I'll be there in an hour." Or if it was wintertime, "Dude, we're going skiing." And his brother would not really want to get out of bed. He'd say, "I'll be there in an hour. We're going skiing." And now those are very precious memories for everyone in the family. I, like Bob, I contacted Peaceful Tomorrows on the web. My first contact was with Andrew. He invited me to join Peaceful Tomorrows in Washington in January of this year for the protest against the war in Iraq. But we were never able to find each other in that huge crowd. So he then said, "Well, meet us in New York at the protest in February," when the entire world, in fact, raised its voice for peace. And I met all the members of Peaceful Tomorrows and knew that this was the group that I needed to work with to let my voice be heard for peace.
How did your family feel about you going to these demonstrations?
Well, my oldest son felt very strongly that we needed to stop Saddam Hussein. Whether or not there was a link to 9/11, he felt that there were weapons, he believed, that there were weapons that needed to be found and that we should not allow them to fall into the hands of terrorists. So he didn't approve of what I was doing, but by the same token, he respected my right to do what I believed in. My youngest son also did not believe in the peace movement, but he also was not critical of my activities. My daughter was very supportive and, in fact, marched herself in the peace protests in Los Angeles. And after I was arrested with Bob and Rita Lazar in Washington on March the 17th, my four-year-old grandson would chant when he marched, "No blood for oil, my grandma's a jailbird." So there was support and there was some difference of opinion, but we were all able to get along.
Did you find any support in the firehouse where Tim worked?
The firemen that Timmy knew, and again, and I don't know what Timmy himself would have thought of my activities. The firemen believed what they were told by the government, and evidently there had been a liaison that spoke to them from the FBI or the CIA that should terrorists get a hold of weapons of mass destruction, the fire department was the entity that would have to take care of it. They were the ones that would have to respond. And so their feeling was, if we can get rid of them in Iraq before they're brought here, then that's what we had to do.
Megan Bartlett is now sitting next to you, and she is part of a group, founded a group, Ground Zero Workers for Peace. She was not at the World Trade Center when the planes struck, but raced over. Welcome, Megan.
Hello.
Can you talk about that day? And then we'll talk about the firefighters, the police, the EMTs that you have been working with, those that are for war, those that are against. But what happened on September 11th for you?
I guess I'd first like to say it's hard to remember that day in many ways, particularly when I listen to the stories of people from Peaceful Tomorrows, because the desire to have given them a different outcome is so intense. To have not been able to save their particular family members and all the rest of them comes in as a very personal burden. I think that's true for every uniformed first responder. I'm not speaking for myself on that. But having said that, the day was as horrific as one might imagine, except for so much worse. I remember trying to get a picture in my head of something that it seemed similar to, and I thought back to old war movies. I thought to, like, Burnout, you know, Berlin and London, and pictures I understood of Vietnam, and nothing made sense. It didn't make sense that I would be there in my own country, that something like this would happen. And as a child of the Cold War, I thought, this is it. This is what they were talking about. This is the destruction we were so scared of for so long. And immediately, you know, I recognized that no one, myself included, should ever have to see this. And yet people all around the world have known this and seen this before. It was like being instantly connected to a mass of humanity. And now I understand what I see on the news.
That morning, you were in bed?
That morning, I was in bed, and I heard the I don't know if I heard it or felt it, but like a jar. And I like quickly realized what had happened because our TVs were out, but our neighborhood was, everyone was outside yelling about what had happened. And so I tossed on part of my uniform, grabbed my tech bag, and found my way to an ambulance and made it down to the site. Still terrified about what I saw. And I didn't even see the worst of it. There are people down there that saw much worse than I did. And the whole entire day was a hurry up and wait to do nothing. There was so much to do and yet nothing to do. You know, we're trained to go to a scene where there's chaos or where people are terrified in the way people get terrified when someone they love is sick. And we go in, we take control, we make people feel better. Not only the people that are sick, but the family members. And here we come to a situation where it's clearly, clearly beyond our control. In training, when you become an EMT, they talk about what we learned from the World Trade Center bombing. And of course, they're talking about the previous bombing. And that was sort of our idea of what a mass casualty incident was.
That was 1993.
Right. And now...
I think 6 people killed?
I think. And... but that was our idea. That was sort of our concept of how to deal with something. And that, you know, you get a perimeter around it, you understand how to triage. And that day, it was beyond this, even though, don't mistake me, people did an incredibly good job. People did their job well, with immense care and immense devotion. But it was the job too big. Who's trained for that?
Many EMTs lost their lives.
Right.
Is that right? As well as firefighters.
Firefighters.
Yes. So how did you go from there and spending those days there to founding this organization, being part of this organization that you are? It's called?
Ground Zero for Peace, First Responders Against the War. First responders are, we're basically a group of people whose work lives have brought them in contact with 9/11 or the aftermath. We're people who dedicated our lives to the city long before 9/11, and uniformed public servants, some from private companies. I myself was from a private company. Afterwards, a group of us, I mean, we're a shattered community, completely shattered. Losing a coworker is a very interesting, horrific thing to go through, and even if you didn't know them, it was a gaping hole, and society doesn't come around you the way they do when, you know, an immediate family member lost. And it's certainly not that, but it is, you know, everything you trust about this. You know, we have dangerous jobs. It's knowing that these people are no longer there, you know, give proof of how scary our work is and what it's like to go to work and what you have to be up for.
I was very struck the other night when there was an event for the book that has just been written, Peaceful Tomorrows, that describes the whole movement of people who lost loved ones who are against war. By your quote of the firefighter, when you were talking about what it meant to speak out now for peace.
Yeah, it's interesting. We started organizing around health issues because everybody just felt like either had really serious things going on or just felt like crud, basically. And we were wondering where the federal money was for us, and especially after being told that, at Ground Zero, in other words, that we were the best America had to offer, that we were the heroes of 9/11, that we would be taken care of. And, well, you know, we have some, the weird word hero is a little odd in general, but we didn't see any of this coming our way, and we weren't asking for anything. We were just asking that our health be taken care of, that we have full access to information about what chemicals we were exposed to. And then what we realized, we started thinking about what we had been through, and I read somewhere that the life expectancy of an Afghan was 48 years old, and I thought, oh my God, that makes sense. Living through something like that, what we lived through was about 40 minutes of violence, and then you multiply that by 22 years, it's too much for a system, it's too much for somebody to do. And yet, as scary as violence is and war is, what many of my members think is that it's actually scarier, you know, that it's a very, to directly quote one of my members, that, you know, something's very wrong with the world when I'm not afraid to run up a 104-story burning building, but I'm afraid to speak out and say that I'm for peace.
Well, we're going to break and then come back and speak with Fakak Mamdouth, who worked at the Windows on the World, but worked the late shift, lost many of his friends and co-workers. We're going to speak with Jeremy Glick, who lost his dad at the World Trade Center. We're going to talk with Andrew Rice, who lost his brother David. And we'll talk about, well, here you all are here, in terms of the mainstream media, hearing the descriptions of your loved ones, hearing about what you went through, we do hear. But when it comes to your views on war, these are not what's highlighted on these anniversaries. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Song of Qataran from the Anthology of World Music, the music of Afghanistan. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk to people who lost loved ones at the World Trade Center 2 years ago, part of our three-part series on the second anniversary of September 11th, 2001, Fakak Mamdouth is in the studio with us. He worked at Windows on the World, which was the top floor of the World Trade Center. Can you describe Windows on the World for people who've never been there?
Well, first, thank you for inviting me. And Windows on the World was not the top floor. It was 107. It was another four floors where all the media, and that's where the antenna was, that building with the antenna was, so was all the media, TVs, and everything in those four floors. But the highest you can go is our floor, 107 floor. And
what did you do there?
I used to be waiter and shops to union delegate for all the workers inside there. So I know everybody by name. So.
And where were you that morning?
I was sleeping because I work late, and the next I was supposed to be there at 2 o'clock.
Now, that morning, there was an unusually large event taking place at Windows on the World, which required a lot of the workers to be there. Is that right?
True. It's supposed to be a party of 500 people in breakfast, but somehow it was like getting less and less, and it ended up with 98 guests coming to that party. So imagine if it's the 500 people, we're going to lose more than 73, because in every 10 people, they put one waiter. So
that morning, September 11th, how did you hear what had taken place?
Like I said, I was sleeping that morning, and my sister from Italy saw the news in Al Jazeera, and she called me and woke me up, said, "Are you home?" I said, "Yes." And she said, "Turn the TV and see what's going on." So I was like, everybody went, turned the TV, and they said the first building burning. Then I was like, my God, it's another 4 months. We're not going to work. I was not waiting for the building to collapse or another plane to come and hit the second building. And when we were training at Windows on the World, they told us even a plane hit the building, it would not collapse the building. It would just damage it. because the building is so strong. So to me, it was like, there is no way this building gonna collapse. Yes, there is damage there. It's gonna take some time. We're gonna fix it. We're gonna go back to work. Didn't happen.
How many coworkers did you lose?
73.
You knew them all?
Like 95% of them. I know them by name, families, and everybody. I used to be the shop steward, so I was to be the delegate, so I know everybody. Anybody have a problem with the management, I'm there with the human resource and discussing their matters and problems. And so.
So what did you do afterwards? How did you find out who was alive, who didn't make it, who wasn't there, who happened to just have shown up to fill in for someone else?
Well, that the whole that day I was sitting home like everybody in New York here watching TV because it was no movements. But the next day, early in the morning, I was in the union, the local HERE, Local 100. And
hotel employees, restaurant employees, exactly. HERE.
That's the only place that all the worker comes, union or non-union peoples go there. And they give us make a small ID for us saying this is a church member. And we went to all the hospitals in New York, all the morgues. We went all the way to New Jersey to see if we can find somebody. And we have in like a plate said, if you know somebody who work at Windows, please talk to me, because it was a lot of people all over. And we come up with the list of 73 after 1 week.
So you set up a kind of search party?
Yeah.
73 people?
73 people.
And what did you do then? What have you done over these 2 years?
Well, since 9/12 of 2001, I've been working, helping families, helping members, helping displaced workers. First, we have a lot of undocumented people. You know, it's a restaurant business in New York, like 20% to 30% are undocumented people. So people, they lose their families, they lose their father or mother or somebody in the family, they are undocumented. So they're scared to go to ask for help or to ask if they find their husband or their father. So they will come to us and we will go with them and seek help for them. And none of them can go to Pier 94 where all this aid was, governments put that tent there where everybody can go there and ask for their loved one and ask for help. Our members, they were like scared. First, some of them, they are undocumented. And second, the barrier of language, because most of them are, they don't speak English. And in the first day, it was very hard. And also the people that they bring to work, like the Red Cross and other people that come to help our members, our families here in New York, they come from other places from the country, which they don't understand our needs. So they want to help you, yes, but when you told them that my mortgage is $2,000, they look at you like, $2,000? What do you want to do with $2,000? They don't have this need exactly like us here in New York. So it was very hard in the beginning to deal with.
What is ROC, New York?
Well, after that, the union called Saru Jayaraman, which the executive director of ROC New York, and they called me and to ROC New York is the Restaurant Opportunity Center, and we find it so we can help the ongoing need of the displaced worker from all over New York and from the World Trade Center, find jobs, seek help, and classes and a lot of stuff. And one of our major thing that we do in those days is we are opening up a co-op restaurant, which every member of this co-op, which 43 to 50 people, going to be an owner. It's going to be a big restaurant here in Tribeca. It's going to be legacy to our people that we lost that day. It's going to be, the good things about it, it's going to be good salaries. It's going to be, people going to be working with dignity, with respect. And from the dishwasher to management, it's going to be, everybody going to be owner, have one share.
And it's going to be called The ROC?
We don't know the name yet. There is a lot of names showing on there, like Windows on Tribeca, but we don't know the name. We're going to discuss name with our 50 members.
Well, Fekak Mamduth, you're sitting next to Jeremy Glick. Jeremy, on September 11th, you lost your dad. Where?
He was, I believe, in Tower 1. He works for the Port Authority in the Treasury Department. There was 100 workers with him. He was a supervisor, so he was one out of three that didn't make it. He and the other two people who I know were helping a woman on another floor who was paralyzed with an asthmatic attack. So that was his...
How did you hear?
About the Trade Center? Or
and
about
how
my
did
father?
You hear about what your father was doing then? How did you learn?
I was walking down George Street in New Brunswick, New Jersey, going to teach a class on the Black Arts Movement and poetry. And a community activist named Penny, who I work with doing support services for drug users in New Brunswick and homeless itinerant drug users in New Brunswick, just flippantly mentioned it to me. And I got to school and everyone was outside all teary-eyed. And I just went right to a local TV and just sat down with a couple of professors of mine and just waited and tried to get, in, you know, cell phone contact. And then I ended up just being really upset and kind of drunk. So friends of mine drove me home, and I spent the next 8 weeks just holding it down at my mom's house.
Hmm. You had the very odd experience of another person named Jeremy Glick dying in the plane, right?
Yeah.
That went down.
And we have a lot of geographic and age and athletic similarities, so...
He became well known as one of the people who fought off the who tried to fight the hijackers.
Right, and a comrade of mine from the MOVE organization, who and a victim of terrorism, said that's something Jeremy would do. So a lot of people, including political activists, you know, ex-partners, people from grade school, law enforcement, including the FBI, called my mom during that time, which was crazy enough because of my father, to say, you know, Mrs. Glick, your son unfortunately died as a hero. And Mrs. Glick was like, no, he's there eating coffee cake. It's my father that you got to worry about.
Hmm. And he was in an entirely different place.
Yeah, I mean, he was a couple of years...
World Trade Center.
Yeah, and he was a couple of years older than me, but he lived really close to my parents, and we both had accolades for martial arts. Yeah, uh-huh. So people got us confused. But, you know, he's... So, and my mom actually got to meet his mother, so which is kind of surreal.
So you have spent this 2 years. It's rare, as I was saying before, that people who have voiced strong opinions against the war and have lost loved ones are in the mainstream media. You
right.
sometimes see them describing the first half, their loved ones. But when it comes to not the description but the prescription, saying no to war, they're cut away from, and the experts that... terrorism experts are turned to, like Henry Kissinger and Oliver North. But you did have a moment.
Well, they have first-hand experience in terrorism, so I would call them, too, before me. you know, last time I terrorized someone, I was 9. So, yeah, I mean, I was on the Bill O'Reilly show, and we had, the televised infamous battle where he terrorized me and said I was a disgrace to my father, and he felt bad for my mom, and physically threatened me. I provoked him to physically threaten him, but I wasn't violent or profane. I told Bill O'Reilly that at the end of the taping that he was the inverse of his parent company show on Fox, Joe Millionaire, because he's actually a millionaire white supremacist fronting like a working class white guy. And he told me that he was going to tear me to effing pieces if I didn't leave
his
studio.
Well, let's hear what happened right before that happened. Just a clip.
You didn't support the action against Afghanistan to remove the Taliban. You were against it.
Why would I want to brutalize and further punish the people in Afghanistan?
Who killed your father?
The people in Afghanistan didn't kill my father.
Sure they did. The Al-Qaeda people were trained there.
The Al-Qaeda people? What about the Afghans?
See, I'm more angry about it than you are.
So what about George Bush?
What about George Bush? He had nothing to do with it.
The director, senior, as director.
He had nothing to do with it.
So the people that trained 100,000 Mujahideen who were extremists.
I hope your mom isn't watching this.
Oh,
I hope your mother is not watching this. Because you... That's it. I'm not going to say anymore.
Okay.
In respect for your father...
It's September 14th. Do you want to know what I was doing?
Shut up.
Please don't tell me to shut up.
In respect for your father, who was a Port Authority worker, a fine American who got killed unnecessarily by barbarians.
By radical extremists trained by this government.
Respect
not
for
the
him.
People of America,
I'm not
the people, the ruling
you.
Class, the small minority.
Cut his mic. I'm not going to dress you down anymore. Out of respect for your father. We'll be back in a moment with more of the
fact. We're done?
We're done.
And that was Jeremy Glick on Bill O'Reilly as you came on as having lost your father in the World Trade Center. Andrew Rice, you lost your brother at the World Trade Center, and I want to ask your reaction to seeing Jeremy on Bill O'Reilly, but I want to ask your own experience first of that day.
Yeah, my brother David was transferred from Chicago to New York City, where I was living here, and my sister, about 8 months before 9/11, he worked for an investment firm, Sandler O'Neill. You know, happened to be there that morning. If it was a week later, he would have been traveling on business. I was in Toronto working and for the week, and I got a call about it. And when I got a call after the first plane had hit, which was not his building, he was in the second building. He called my parents and talked to them, and sort of he actually said, you know, that he was going to try to get out, but it was out of his control, and he would try to get back to him. And when I heard the first plane hit, I just had this intuitive feeling it's not an accident. I said that was just my reaction. You know, I knew that in 93 with the bombing, and I knew that this was a huge target for extremists. Then when I saw the second plane hit, you know, I had a sense that he was gone pretty soon. Like Bob, we were lucky his body was found very early, and they actually took a photo. The fire department took a photograph of his body, and there was about 15 or 20 photographs that they were taking very early on of remains that they were finding, bodies that they were finding, and they realized in the efforts to try to find survivors that they couldn't continue to take photographs. So we were lucky in that sense. It's weird to use that word, but we were. It started a strange journey for me to deal with my anger of my brother getting killed, but also knowing very soon that this would be exploited by the government. They made it very clear that we weren't going to take a sober, thoughtful, multilateral approach to how to deal with it, that it was going to be, this is what we're going to do. And it was going to be awful, to put it simplistically. I Found Peaceful Tomorrow is about 2 months after it began, on Valentine's Day 2002, when the founders of the group sent a Valentine's card to George W. Bush, and began going around. I had moved to Texas near my roots. I grew up in that area of the country to do political work there, which I found over what's happened the last two years, there's a whole lot of people who are misinformed in this country, and especially in the quote-unquote heartland of the country. And so I was going to small communities and talking to people about not only why we shouldn't go into the war, but really educating them about the reality of what's going on. You know, when all they hear is that there's this evil man who's going to come kill their kids tomorrow, they don't really want to hear about Iraqi children or Afghani children. They're going to get killed. So a lot of the work that I was doing in Peaceful Tomorrow was trying to give them the facts first. And it's interesting, people who voted for George W. Bush, moderate Republicans, who would come up to me afterwards and say, you know, I understand more now about what the anti-war movement's about, and I agree more with it. But the mainstream media like to put us in little boxes as sort of idealistic pacifists who don't really, you know, we were the more, I think, actually the people calling out against the war, coming out against the war, were the more realists over the last year. I mean, who's the idealist? People who think you can bomb a country into democracy. You know, who are the realists and who are the idealists here? Who are the radicals? So this week is an emotional time for my family, all the other families, New Yorkers, Americans, you know, it's almost more difficult this year personally than last year, in emotional ways, and also because so much more awful things have happened, and knowing also that the campaign for re-election is coming up, and that the president's going to really try to exploit this tragedy for his own purposes.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming here so close to Ground Zero. We're just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. We'll be out tonight following the vigil from Union Square down to Ground Zero, and there will also be a concert for peace, supporting Peaceful Tomorrows. The book that has come out on the organization, Peaceful Tomorrows, by David Pottorti, who lost his brother James, is called Peaceful Tomorrows. And that ends our show tomorrow, a special on 911, the 911s around the world. Democracy Now! Is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.